I am delighted to be here, by the way. Let me introduce myself. My name is Andres Velasco. I'm the Dean of the School of Public Policy. And I am delighted to be hosting Professor Guillermo Larraín and two very distinguished discussants, whom I will introduce in a minute, who will speak on what is to me at least a big issue, stabilizing the social contract, the case of Chile. At some point it was called the paradoxical case of Chile. Did we get rid of paradoxical?
No.
Okay. But my notes don't say paradoxical, but yes, it is paradoxical. Rest assured. Economist. Okay, so I need to give you some instructions, first of all. If you're tweeting, the hashtag for today's event is LSE Public Policy. Please, no phones. Yes, thank you very much. Okay, and of course, we will have a presentation. We will have comments by the two discussants, and then we will open it up to Q&A from everybody. I've known these three people for quite a long time, but I'm going to read their official bios to make sure that I don't miss their extraordinary achievements. Guillermo Larraín is Associate Professor in the Department of Economics at the University of Chile. He was Vice President and then President of the State Bank of Chile, the Banco Estado, if you speak Spanish. Before that, he was the Superintendent of Securities and Insurance and the Superintendent of Pensions in the Republic of Chile. He is the author of The Stability in the Social Contract in Chile, Perspectives from Within the Middle Income Trap. So Guillermo, delighted to be hosting you, but before I give you the microphone, I'm going to introduce our distinguished discussants. And I should say that Javier, whom I'm about to introduce, is a professor at Queen Mary, and Queen Mary is a co-sponsor of this event. So Javier Zajuria is a reader and associate professor in comparative politics and the deputy dean for education at the Faculty of Humanities and Social Sciences, Queen Mary University, London. He's also the president of the Chilean Political Science Association. His research interests include electoral politics, specifically British and Chilean politics. They have been getting more similar recently, I've noticed. I hope that's not a trend. Please come right in. And of course, we are delighted to welcome, I shouldn't say welcome because she's a local, Dr. Kirsten Sembrook, who is a British Academy Global Professor and Distinguished Policy Fellow at the LSE III International Inequalities Institute. I was about to say III Institute, but that would be four I's, right? So that would not be quite right. Before that, she was a research fellow at the University of Chile, the director of the Institute for Public Policy at the Universidad Diego Portales, also in Chile, and a lecturer at the University of California, Berkeley. Kirsten was born in Germany, grew up in England mostly, and speaks Spanish like a Chilean, which is an extraordinary achievement for somebody who was not born there, or a terrible achievement. I don't know. Either one. Okay.
I was Argentina.
Okay. Well, we will not talk about that. Without further ado, Professor, the floor is yours. Thank you for joining us.
Okay, so thank you very much, Andres, for the presentation, and thank you all of you for being here. I'm very honored to be in this room and with so many people. I hope that the presentation will be of interest for you. I should say that when I was superintendent of securities and insurance, I had a boss, and my boss is here present. Imagine, Joe, who was my boss? And it was a great time that I enjoyed working with you, Andres. I'm happy to be here now that you are dean at LSE. So I will talk about the paradoxical situation that Chile has lived in the last several years. And I titled this Building More Stable Contracts, because I believe that we should all try to build more stable social contracts. And therefore, the Chilean experience can help in this regard. So Chile was a kind of quiet place in which we produced wine and we enjoyed the sun and there were some snow on the mountains and everything was perfectly well. And suddenly October of 2019, something happened that people started destroying the metro, which was the jewel crown of the public sector in Chile. They started destroying the metro station, 77 stations in Santiago that were partially destroyed over one weekend. The center of Santiago was basically—
12
were
fully destroyed.
12 were fully destroyed. And the center of Santiago was basically a kind of battlefield, not only over that weekend, but for the next 3 months, in which there were every day, not just manifestations, demonstrations, violence, destruction, people that lost their eyes, their eyes. And a lot of people, some people that died in that process. And all that was to some extent institutionalized, to be more clear. In order to institutionalize and to give some issue to that extreme social conflict, there was this, the parliament enacted the a conventional process. And there you have in the left hand side at the bottom, the inauguration of that convention. So of course the first paradox is how can we pass from a peaceful process of progress to this kind of extreme event of violence and social distress? And the second one is how can we pass from this convention that is there in the Congress that was elected with relatively excellent conditions and rules to this, to nothing. So we're left today in a process in which there is nothing. We don't have a new, we don't have a new process in front of us. It's not clear what path will the country follow. There is a minority government in the country, which has a lot of difficulties in passing the program. So in principle, we are left in this kind of very strange situation. So there are two paradoxes. One, the social explosion despite economic and social progress. I call that the Tocqueville paradox applied to Chile. And then the democratic election 1 year of with a strong majority for this process, a conventional process, that was rejected by also a very massive vote 1 year later on, and I call the Arrow paradox. I will not explain the names of that, but the topics are relatively clear. Okay, so let me just two slides in case you don't know the flag, that is the flag. Okay, so this is, there was significant progress in Chile. Okay, so you have here between 1990 and 2018, the GDP per capita in Chile, we started in 1990 with an income per capita of $5,500 per capita. It was the fifth economy at the time. And there's been a steady progress. And by the end of the sample, just before the social explosion, Chile was the first economy in terms per capita terms in the region. This is not just GDP. Well, the titles are intended to mean something. You know, you can hear, you cannot read that. But what it says is that what should have gone up went up. So you wanted the income of the poorest 10% of the population to go up, it went up from an index of 10 to an index of 439. If you wanted the minimum wage to increase, it went up from 100 to 309. And therefore, you can read the rest of the information that is there. And what should have decreased. For example, military spending that was very, very high after a dictatorship, 3.4% of GDP as spending in the military, it went down to 1.9. And inflation, it was 22, it became in 2018, 2%. So this was not just a matter of GDP. It's not just overall material progress. There was significant progress in social areas, which is very clear in this. So why is that we ended up in this situation? Okay. Well, let me say that In principle, this is because we are trying to understand the world using what could be stated as utilitarian conceptual framework. If there are more goods and means available for consumption, for investment, for the population, we should necessarily be in a better situation. And this is not exactly what is happening. And therefore, I stress the fact that we should try to analyze problems with what I call a contractualist approach. So during several years, we have enormous economic and social progress, and various forms of inequality were rising over the years that put, if you want, some sand in the wheels. This is a term that we use in international finance, sand in the wheels in the process of economic growth. And at some point, that sand of the wheels that hasn't, if you want to see the numbers in productivity terms, in GDP growth terms, there is a steady decrease in those numbers. So at some point, these various forms of inequality started really blocking economic progress. So how can we enlarge our understanding of what happened? What I did here is a very simple exercise. Because I was superintendent of securities and commission, then I worked a lot with private contracts. So what if we try to analyze the social contract, trying to understand why private contracts are voluntarily broken in the terms that there is disloyalty to the original terms in which those contracts were underwritten. And when you look at different dimensions of this, you end up with four general ways by which people is disloyal to the initial terms of the contract. Inequalities in the distribution of burdens. For example, if you have a company that is making transactions with related parties, and therefore the majority shareholder of the company holds a larger proportion of the benefit, when the rest of the shareholders will complain, because there is a distributional problem in that contract that will induce that contract will be broken. And you can also discuss inequalities of burdens, inequalities in the distribution of risks, and exclusions. So what I tried is to use these four very broad terms that explain how a private contract can be voluntarily broken to understand what happened in Chile in the last several years. So I will speak not of the four because we don't have enough time. I will explain two of these dimensions. And I will start by exclusions and segregations. And in particular, regarding one very specific element, which is very important for the life of everyone, not just in Chile, but in any country, which is social rights. In social rights, as I said, there were improvements in coverage, significant improvements in coverage in all respects, but with a significant financing from families and segregation. Why? The explanation we gave in a book that I wrote before the stability of the social contract, which was called The Other Model, blamed to some extent or gave a lot of responsibility to the emphasis that the Chilean social policy had in using market forces as a means of organizing the allocation of social rights. And this excess emphasis on market forces induced some different forms of segregation or excessive burden in financing terms to families. You can see that in many respects. I have some slides here on education. For example, here you have total education, the total spending in education that Chile has compared with many countries in the OECD. And Chile is one of the countries that is spending the most in primary to post-secondary education, but is the country which is spending the most in terms of education, in tertiary education, in terms, of course, of GDP. And the bulk of that is basically financed by private effort. It's families that are paying, that are using a lot of their income for financing education in the case of tertiary education in Chile. And in primary to post-secondary education is the same. a lot of the effort of the families is devoted to financing this. The other side of the coin is that the...
Between the red and the blue and the white?
No, because it was Germany, because I made the same I made the same presentation in Germany some days ago, and I didn't change the slide. Sorry, I should have put the UK as a benchmark, but I used German. So that's private. In private spending, therefore, in tertiary education, Chile is the country in the within the OECD that is spending the most in tertiary education, and is the third in terms of primary to post-secondary non-tertiary education. So a lot of spending in this financed basically by families. Now, when you go to the outcomes of this, there is a lot of evidence on this. I put this because it's a very provocative chart made by Sergio Ursúa and Echenique 2012, so it's not too updated, but it shows more or less the story. The story is that you have the metro line, line one, it goes across Santiago from east to west, and there is a very strong correlation, as you may see, between the location, the difference between the distance between the different metro stations with the center of Santiago and the neighborhoods in which there is more rich people, and the achievements by measured by this CIMSE test, which it's basically tries to identify the quality of education for kids in fourth grade. So a lot of effort from on the families, and the distribution of that effort is extremely correlated with the income of those same families. So if you could eventually say that the statement that the educational system should to some extent level the playing field among children is to some extent put into question. Here you have the share of out-of-pocket expenditure, and then I have Chile, as you see, is the country, I'm not sure was the first or one of the, I believe it's the first one in terms of the expenditure of out-of-the-pocket in terms of healthcare. This has to do with different expenditures that are made by families in attaining medical attention.
30% of the total expenditure?
Yes, exactly. Okay, so let me talk about risk. I attach a lot of importance to this point. What's the point? Is that in the social reforms that were made in the 80s in Chile, the privatization of the pension system, the inclusion of market forces in the educational system, in the health system, wanted something that to some extent was reasonable, was to transfer some risks out of the state, because the state, some of those risks cannot really handle them well. Well, the problem is that those which are risks for the state, when they are transfers to individuals, they are no longer risk, they are uncertainty. Why? Because individuals cannot, if you cannot assess the probability distribution of what will happen to them. Okay, the government can do that because it has a whole population, so I can more or less say the characteristics of this group. It's a large group here. I could say more or less what do you think in terms of left and right in some areas, but I could not tell what do you think. I don't know you. I can't tell what it's you. For me, it's uncertain. For the group, it's risky. Okay, so this transfer. So this type of policy is transferred a lot of uncertainties to society, and uncertainty we know that it's bad for economics, it's even worse for individuals, and this is a problem that I think deserves to be understood better. Now, transferring back this to the state, it requires significant governance capacity. I just add this phrase here because Chile today, one problem that we shall see in the next paradox is that we are really suffering a problem of governance. And therefore transferring back this to the state is a real issue there. Let me show you this. And I understand that Christian will talk about this a little bit, but this is made by a COES survey. And it shows basically that in 3 years, 2016, 17, and 18, in which growth was not significant, but there was no crisis. In those three years, 37% of the population at some point was living under poverty. So it has enormous vulnerability, in particular in the middle classes. And therefore, this is the type of vulnerability, uncertainties that people live, and I believe it is very bad for the evolution of society. Now, I explained there, I presume I explained more or less my view on the first paradox. The second paradox, there was this situation in which there was a social explosion that was managed by institutionalizing this constituent process. It was massively voted in favor, massively. 1 year later, it was massively rejected, the outcome of that. Now, what is the problem? Was it that, one important thing is that the rules that framed this process were rules that were chosen in that particular context of destruction, social distress. And therefore, the rules were, in principle, quite reasonable. But when you look at the details, and I will talk about the details, when you look at the details, you see that the significant problems were present in those rules. Let me rule out from the scratch that the convention was formed by people that didn't have the knowledge sufficient for making this thing. When you look at the constitution or the composition of the convention, there were 59 lawyers. Among the 59 lawyers, at least eight had a PhD in law. Among them, there were at least the three, four, or five most prestigious constitutional lawyers in the country. Then you have teachers, engineers, journalists. There was one economist, which I presume is among the engineers in the 12th. But then you have, I couldn't translate all the rest that you have there, but you have a lot of people from different backgrounds. So the problem was not that they were unable to understand what they were doing. The problems were the rules, okay? Now, one thing that I thought it was a very important point at the beginning was that there was no controlling stakeholder of the convention. I thought that this was very fine, and it ended up not being that good. So there you have the composition among different groups. The largest group in the convention was formed by right-wing people. But the right-wing people, half of them were totally against the process. Other groups were more constructive, but the largest group was the one that basically was against the program. Then there was significant, 42% of the convention were independent people. And many of those independent members of the convention were activists in various dimensions, environmental, gender, Aboriginal people and the like. So the largest group were independent that didn't have stakes in the future of the direct stakes in the future of the of whatever came out of the of the of the convention. The convention was quite to the left. So this is on the black solid line is the center, and this is a metric which is it's there. The you can see the methodology there. It's made by the Centro Estudios Públicos, and you see that the right was, of course, on the right. It's not surprising, I hope, but the rest is to the center left, to the left, and quite to the left. So when you start mixing up all these things, I run out of time, but let me finish with this because I'm concluding here. There are six conclusions to understand why this is contradiction. The first is that there were too many independent people and they weakened financial political parties. As we know, political parties, they have multiple interests and they are able to balance and to make trade-offs among themselves, whereas independents are very difficult for them to agree on compromises. There was a very transparent process, and this everyone thought that it was a good thing, but transparency is fine unless you reach a point in which you need to recognize that you were wrong at the beginning, that you want to change your mind, that you learn something, because most of these people, in particular the independent people, had no experience at all in politics. So how can you show yourself proudly saying that I was wrong in the first place? So that's the transparency at the end of the day was excessive. The commissions were self-selected, and therefore the activists were to the commissions in which they were more interested. But the point is that activists are, let me put it very, very, very strong, are single-minded. And when you're trying to build a constitution, you cannot be single-minded, because you need to create a space, an institutional space, in which therefore society and political and the future of democracy will choose how to deal with those trade-offs. When you have this kind of thing, well, that's more difficult. Activists also proposed topics that Chile was not prepared at all to discuss before because they were totally new. And the clearest case is that they proposed that Chile should become a plurinational country. I examined all the presidential candidates' programs, including Professor Velasco's program, and you didn't have plurinationality in your platform. There was only one candidate that specifically talked about plurinationality. It was a center left, was Claudio Rego, that was with you. It was a Christian Democrat. The left didn't speak about this in all the 10 years before. So this activist managed to put that into the table, not only into the table of the commission, but then at the plenary level as well. The right was underrepresented, and the left could not see that this underrepresentation harmed the capacity of the convention to reach reasonable agreements. They thought that the right was to some extent beaten and forever, and that's not true. The right in Chile has basically more than 35% of the vote, and here they had basically 24. And fragmentation. The fragmentation in the convention, as I showed, was significantly and increased over time. There was a lot between the right, there were two groups, between the Lista del Apruebo, two groups, the independent candidates, Lista del Pueblo, spread also in several groups. So without majority leadership and any counterweight to handle this, we had to rely only in the self-restraint of some large, so to speak, large groups in the left, and that didn't work. So we ended up with the most kind of extreme positions being there that didn't match exactly what the country was expecting from this. So I leave this there, so you can, it's basically the abstract of what I just said, and thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Guillermo. Which one of the two discussants would like to jump to the frame? Kirsten, you want to be next? Wonderful, thank you very much. Maybe you can swap chairs. Guillermo can.
Oh, thank you. That was very enlightening for somebody who no longer follows Chile on a day-to-day basis. And I have to say, I'm going to start by saying that when I first read Guillermo's presentation today, I was reminded of the time when I would come to the LSE to present my own work on Chile here, before this whole crisis. And there would inevitably be people in the audience who would say, we've got all of those problems in the UK as well. Uh-huh. To which I would respond, yeah, but Chile, it's a different war, it's a different extent, and it's more, and et cetera. And as Andres was saying, you know, these developments are sort of converging. And now I'm on the UK side, of course, and I'm reading Guillermo's presentation, and my instinctive reaction is, yeah, it's just like the UK. So either that's a sign of convergence or...
No letters.
Anyway, I'm going to make sort of three comments that, and then questions for you. One on the socioeconomic perspective that you showed. You showed some of the data that that I think highlights the issues quite well. The 46% on your slide of people who are either experience poverty during this period of time, either fluctuating in and out or remain poor, are also the people that I look at from a labor market perspective. And I'm pretty certain that if we cross the data, they would be pretty much the same people. And I completely agree, of course, with your assertion that the state has not only transferred risk, but that this has generated a tremendous amount of uncertainty. In the advanced economies, we have, again, similar processes going on, but we have welfare states that cover these cracks, really, in the foundations of our welfare state with subsidies, leading to quite a significant subsidization of this segment of the labor market through transfers, earned income tax credits, and so on, which, of course, in Chile, we don't have. And so, you know, thinking about the way this is structured in Chile, and especially currently now with a pension reform that's being discussed, the first point I'd like to say, especially in view of your expertise on the pension system and the interviews you've been giving, regardless of how you structure a pension reform or a welfare state or other social insurance systems, if this is the foundation that's so cracked, this labor market that's so precarious, none of these are going to work. And actually, also, it doesn't matter much whether it's a private system or a public system. None of these are going to work and function and cover these deficits that particularly, of course, hit the middle class in a way that is satisfactory. So I think that's something that's often overlooked in these discussions, because just another subsidy is not going to fix this. People who are living on transfers and who are using transfers in order to survive don't necessarily feel as though they're doing well. And so therefore you end up again with a middle class that is being squeezed, but also subsidized. And the vulnerability that you point out that is felt by individuals, of course, has increased as a result of a lot of these changes. In Chile in particular, you showed the educational expenditure. It almost feels like the gap between the reality and aspirations has grown, and that this is one of the big causing factors. Again, that's an issue that's very prevalent in the UK. So the question I'm sort of building up to here is, given that we're now in a different economic environment, we've been through the COVID crisis, we're in the middle of an economic crisis. Chile has really suffered, it feels to me, much more now after the COVID crisis than it had in the last, in the Great Recession. So my question really is, has the momentum for structural reform now been lost? Has it shifted significantly? Is that partly why the constitution was rejected? And also in very practical terms, you know, how do you see this reflected in the current debate? So if we're thinking about the pension reform that's being discussed at the moment, to what extent has that shifted as a result of the entire constitutional process and social protests that we've been through, but also now in the context of this economic crisis that I would imagine shifts the parameters a bit? The other sort of general issue I wanted to touch on is you showed a lot of the socioeconomic data. The COIS, which is the Center for Social Conflict and Cohesion that I helped set up and where I worked before coming here. They have done a terrific job of gathering the complementary data. So if you think about this from a class perspective, for example, and think about the Bourdieu approach from economic capital, social capital, cultural capital, they've done a lot of research and run panel surveys on the information that fills a lot of those gaps. And the economic fragility, I think, is very, very clear, very obvious in all of the data. But there's an accompanying lack of political and social identity that comes with this, in particular within the middle class. as you mentioned, I think in your introduction, the middle class is always where these protests are born. And from the data that we have, where we track the protests, who participated in them, and where were the hotspots, and how many people participated in these protests, and that, incidentally, for the audience, the proportion of Chileans who participated in some shape or form in the protests is extremely high. It's somewhere around the region of 80%. Not everybody to the same extent, but everybody at some point participated in some shape or form. Or had, and of course also had family members and friends who participated. So that was really a phenomenon that started in the middle classes and in the student movement, but of course ended up spreading to the whole of society. And this middle class, which is feeling not just vulnerable, as you described, but also pressed in other senses. So this structural sense of injustice that comes from the fact that you have a private system and a public system, the two aren't connected, there are no resources shared, generates a sense of the fact that if there is a public system, it's sort of the upper middle class in Chile, sort of the second and third decile, fourth decile, maybe, of the income distribution that's subsidizing the others, rather than the upper income share contributing its fair share to this process. But there are also many, there's a lot of evidence that came out about how people are feeling that they're being treated. So it's not just that you have a separate system where public and private services are separated, but it's also that the person who's going to a public hospital is treated differently and feels humiliated. I remember my own fieldwork in Chile, the word I most often heard, or that I'd never really heard before, to the same extent, is when you interviewed people from sort of who thought of themselves as lower middle class or working class, this perpetual sense of humiliation about how they were being treated by society, by public services, by politics, and so on. And these sort of class distinctions, of course, interact with new intergroup relations, which are increasingly becoming complicated, such as migrants, the ethnic issues, especially the violence that's sort of coming out in the south, and the existing frameworks that we have for thinking about social class and how this all interacts are a bit complex in terms of how this interplay between traditional social classes that we tend to think about as sociologists from a more traditional perspective interact with these new phenomena, because also some of them are very new. So those of you who don't know Chile very well, migration has shot up within a period of the last 5 years, 6 years. The amount of migrants who have come to Chile are extraordinary. And so those are very unusual and destabilizing phenomena. I don't think we've even begun to see the results of that in the long term. So again, this is all shaping this process. And my question to you is how you see these tensions between these aspirations of these various different social classes and the horizontal inequalities that we also saw very clearly in the constitutional process interact going forwards. So we had, you know, representatives, as you said, activists from the various different groups. So how is this going to be managed going forwards? And again, I think the impact of the COVID crisis and the current economic crisis on the constitutional process, I think, is an interesting question to sort of think about. Are people going to, is the current economic setting going to make people even more risk averse, more averse to change going forwards? And in terms of our sort of, just very finally to conclude, whether we're thinking about social contracts or welfare state or, you know, utilitarian approaches from economics to why this may be happening in the paradox, it feels to me increasingly that in this incredibly complex constellation of crises that we're living through, so COVID, globalization, international conflicts, climate change, all these insecurities that are coming together, and that are also hitting this middle, squeezed middle class, these theories are beginning to feel rather inadequate. And it feels to me like we need to rethink them from, pretty much systemically all the way through. They're no longer that useful in explaining what's going on. So that's, I think, the comment that I was going to close on. My key question really in this context of having to rethink how we approach these issues is what are the lessons from Chile. So especially in the UK, where things are heading in a not too dissimilar direction sometimes.
Thank you very much, Kirsten. Javier Sajuria, the floor is yours, sir. Thanks for coming.
It's water first. All right. So it's great that Kirsten was before me, because all my stuff about kind of people being feeling vulnerable and the changes in the middle class, I can just kind of take it off. I think that I like to start by questioning the premise of the paradox and the notion that we are in the face of a paradox and two paradoxes. We talk about the first paradox being the situation in which a country that is, under any kind of macroeconomic measure, a successful country, somehow came up with a big crisis. And I think that then I think we need to think about what lies behind those measures, what lies behind those metrics. What are we not measuring? What are we not looking in terms of the kind of social grievances that were happening in the country? I usually, when someone comes to me and say, oh, but all the indicators show that things should go in a certain direction, that they don't go in that direction, my first initial thought is, well, that's a measurement problem, right? So you're measuring things, or you're not looking at the right thing. You're not looking at the social process happening. So the first question I want to put to you is, is there a chance that this is not a paradox in light of what we know now, right? In light of all the information we have, the causes of the kind of social rights in 2019, how things have progressed, can we actually speak of a paradox? Or maybe it's something else that goes kind of, and I want to rehearse an explanation that a lot of these social contracts you were mentioning were made at the elite level. And therefore there is a lack of connection between the lived experiences of the social contract and the decision-making process of those contracts. So kind of, I think that can explain some of the issues. And in that way, what we think, and this is kind of my second point, when we look at the constitutional process in particular, we are looking at a particular case in which I think it's particularly interesting in the case of Chile, because Chile has a very persistent and a very closed elite, which I'm going to bring my own research on this, which somehow relates to these experiences of the welfare state, experiences of what constitutes kind of transfers or state transfers. Let me give you some basic examples. You put up the slide on private expenditure and education, so kind of secondary and primary education in particular. There's this interesting survey that came out from COES, actually, from my colleagues, Cristóbal Robin and Jorge Adler, which is an elite survey. And we're working on a book from the survey. That's kind of so fresh in my memory. And when you ask people, members of the Chilean elite, the economic, cultural, and political elite, where did their parents study? Under a third of them will say that they study in a private school. When you ask them about themselves, half of them studied in a private school, and usually in the same 7-8 schools in Santiago, in the eastern region of the city. When you ask, where are the kids studying? 82% are studying in private schools, right? So what we see is an elite that is continuously closing the barriers, very kind of Bourdieu approach, kind of elite closure at its best. And I think that a lot of the processes that happen can be explained or somehow related to this particular particular example. And you probably will tell me, well, in the UK, you have like an upper class, which is actually unreachable. And it's true. It's absolutely true. But as someone who studies political elites, I can tell you the political elite in Chile is much less diverse than the political elite in the UK. And the business elite is less diverse than the... So it's kind of, I mean, yes, Britain's not a particular case of equalitarian, egalitarian society. However, I think the comparison is a bit unfair. Going into the question of the social contract and the inequalities and the different exclusions, I think that one element we're missing is the question about structures. And we talked about this before, before this talk. I'm not a structuralist in any way, but I do have the opportunity to work with a lot of them. So I kind of learned a lot about it. And when you think about inequality, you tend to look at it some sort of as a sort of continuum process in which people move around income scales, and therefore there are kind of some opportunities for people to move around and to kind of improve their position in this sort of interesting scale. And that's also a measurement issue. However, when we think about the social contract, we have this notion that any contract needs to be, starts from the premise that we are among equals. That we are able to negotiate the terms of this contract, which we never do because kind of social contract theory is some sort of an a fictitious process. But in a way, we are in the idea that we can actually negotiate this social contract in a kind of in a notion of equal standing, which is not true. And it's not true not only because of social closure from private schools. It's not true only because of kind of economic standing or the amount of income you have. It's not true because we have gender structural inequalities. We have racial inequalities. Immigration has shot up, as Kristen was saying, and has created all sorts of other structural problems in the country. We have problems in the case of LGBT and trans communities. We have a huge difference between people living in Santiago and people living outside of Santiago. Right. So when you start looking at all these different elements and aspects that not necessarily measure properly by income distribution, you realize that there are structural forces at play. And the question for any contractual explanation of the crisis is, how do you incorporate those elements as a way to make the social kind of make the parts of the social or the parties in the social contract work in an even standard? And probably the answer is that you can't. I mean, there's no real way in which you can somehow make up for all these structural inequalities and make them work and sit them all in a room amongst equals. It doesn't work like that. It's like we talk about Rawls' idea of the veil of ignorance, and the criticism is that it doesn't work. I mean, you can't sit people down in a room thinking what will happen in kind of fictitious conditions, because that's not how we make policies. That's not how we make processes. So therefore, it's a question about how these inequalities or structural processes happen. So how much is agency from the political social actors, and how much is a structural, I want to call it determinism, because I do believe the structure can change, but we need to acknowledge that they exist, and we need to find ways to make them work. So that's one thing from kind of the general element. Now, to go a bit more political before I finish, I think that there are many problems with this constitutional process. And as someone who supported the new constitution and wanted changes afterwards and was bravely defeated in the referendum, trust me, I've learned a lot of lessons about things that can go wrong or not. But the question is, and this is kind of, what could have we done differently in 2019, right? I had the chance to kind of go through the different recordings and the minutes from the technical commission trying to draft the whole process. And I really wonder if they could have come with a different system, for example, a different electoral system, given the conditions, right? So given the political conditions, given the lack of trust in political parties, it's a difficult exercise. We can think about that now in terms of how do we design a new process, if there is going to be any new processes. But it's difficult to put yourselves in the same position of those taking the decisions back in 2019 and thinking, well, what could have been done differently? So for example, when you talk about the lack of sort of major stakeholder in the convention, well, we come from a country where political parties have been uprooted for many years because we have this notion, which I think it's also very performative, as political stability. We didn't worry much about the fact that political parties didn't have roots in social, in kind of civil society. We didn't care about that. That's, in my view, a legacy of the dictatorship and then the whole notion of political parties outside of kind of civil organizations. And we can talk about that if you want to. But in a way, when you have that level of separation, again, between the political elites and the rest of the people, obviously that leads to the fact that it is very difficult to control a space in which political parties are not the main actors. And that happens, that happened in the commission case where you, I mean, if you look at any legislative bodies in the world, most of them have self-selected commissions, right? That's not a new thing. We know that, that's the case. We know that people, those of us who study kind of voting behavior from legislators, we know that the last vote is the non-strategic vote. So you have like different models in which you can predict the way in which they will vote. We know that commissions are mostly about kind of revealed preferences, for example, right? So it's not necessarily about being strategic or open. But the fact that you didn't have any political forces able to control what's happening there, I think that what's made the whole difference, right? So you didn't have any political party that put some level of any whips, right? In the UK case, there are no whips, no three-line whip. I always imagine, like actually in the medieval times, actually with three whips in the entrance of the House of Commons. So that's an interesting case, and I would argue that there was actually a major stakeholder, and that was the Communist Party. And I think that it might be a controversial point to say, but I think that they were very astute in managing to build a third of the convention with kind of people from the indigenous groups and people from the independent candidates. And they used that to block the right, for example. So that the whole idea that you couldn't vote with the right came from the fact that they were able to control that third. So there was a major stakeholder, but not necessarily a constructive one, right? And that's probably another problem that you need to think. And then just to finish, because I don't want to go through, I think we're also dealing with a problem of expectations. And I think it was one of the last points you made. I have done research on kind of preferences towards the constitutional process with Espacio Público. And we kind of followed up the people from the before actually the election of the convention members all the way to kind of last week. And some things are interesting to see. For example, when we asked people right before the election, what was the ideal candidate for the convention? Experts were the ideal candidate for the convention, right? People who were expert on constitutional issues. And if you ask them now, they will tell you exactly the same. But that's not what people elected. I mean, we can talk about the electoral system and how kind of that didn't happen. But in a way, you had an expectation of having a room full of experts, elected experts, of course, but that wasn't delivered. When you ask people about what were the expectations with regards to the behavior of those in the convention, people wanted dialogue. Everyone was saying that they wanted people to get agreements and be able to sacrifice their own kind of their own interest in the sake of a larger agreement. But people were actually, that 70% of people consistently throughout the process were saying that. But then around the same amount of people were saying, that's not what the convention is doing, right? So it's a huge gap between the expectations from citizens and the way in which the behavior of the elected representatives were doing. So I think we have this problem of expectations, which I link it to all the way from elite level closure, lack of social roots from political parties and any organizations to be fair, all the way into this process. So I think we're going through a lot of different problems, structural problems, and based on that, leave it there.
Gracias. So how do we do this? Do we all sit in here in front and we get to pontificate and take questions? Please. One discussion here, one discussion there.
Did we change the Zoom screen or not?
Yeah. Caro, can we maybe just get that out? Brilliant. All right, everybody. Thank you very, very much. I've learned a lot. I've heard things that I thought were right, you know, on the spot, other things that I would disagree with, but that's exactly what the fun is, right? If we agreed with everything, then that would be boring. I'm going to take my chair's privilege to say two things, but I promise I will be very, very brief. The first one is this also on the sociology of knowledge and on how it is that policy gets based on what seems to be true at one time and may not necessarily be true later. You know, when people ask me, why did Chile blow up in pieces?
my response tends to be, you know, true and lies response. You know, you will all remember that, you know, the deputy to Mao in the Chinese Revolution was asked in the 1960s, what do you think of the French Revolution? And he said, oh, time will tell. It's too early to tell. Only 200 and some years have gone by. What worried me, I mean, the estallido social was a tremendous thing, so it worried everybody, and it should have worried everybody. But something else that worried me is that I thought we were too quick to draw conclusions. We were too quick to adopt a certain conventional wisdom, and we were too quick to build policy on that conventional wisdom. And I fear, people might disagree, that a lot of the things that became part of the conventional wisdom and which were then used to build policy happened to be wrong. At least viewed from today's perspective, a lot of the things that were very quickly said were inexact, inaccurate, exaggerated, or sometimes plain wrong. So my first observation is, you know, this is an audience of social scientists. That's what the LSE does, right? Social science is all about slow accumulation of knowledge, gathering evidence, all of that. But of course, if you've been a politician, which I used to be, you know, you have to decide now. And the question is, what knowledge do we use to make those decisions? I worry sometimes that in Chile we use half-baked knowledge or partial knowledge, and we took some decisions and some of them were wrong. The other thing I'd say is that Guillermo drew a lot of very interesting distinctions, and I could speak for half an hour, but I will not. But I will say one thing that strikes me as very precise, and this is one area where the debate is very confused. And I'm going to be a boring economist here, so bear with me for 30 seconds. One issue is the distribution of income on average. On average, some people are poor, some people are middle class, some people are rich. A very different question is the variability of people's incomes around that average. I can be middle class, but if I'm not too far away from the poverty line, shocks will throw me into poverty. One way of interpreting what Guillermo said is that in Chile, the problem was, of course, inequality, but perhaps more than inequality, it was variability, was vulnerability, was exposure to shocks. And I think that's very important from an analytical point of view, but it's even more important from a policy point of view, because it is true that Chileans are much richer than they used to be. I mean, per capita income has quadrupled in the last 35 years. But it is also true that people who are much richer don't feel particularly happy. And if I can put on my hat as a former candidate, I spent years crisscrossing the country talking to people. Standard conversation with the voter is, I live much better than my parents did. My kids will live much better than I live. I grew up in a little hut and now I have a house, and the house has central heating, and I have a car, and I have a mortgage, and my children are at university. I live much, much better. However, and then comes the long list of howevers, my medical insurance is shit. If I lose my job, I have no recourse to anything else. If I lose my job, then my kids may have to be pulled out of university because there's no insurance associated with that. And so it's a very long list of insurances or lack of insurances. And I think we get confused conceptually because we tend to confuse inequality with abuse and abuse with uncertainty. Well, Guillermo was saying something that is very key in my mind. A lot of discussion ought to be about uncertainty or risk. You know, I don't want to get into that technical discussion. People feel richer, but they feel desprotegidos. What's the proper English word for that? Unprotected. That doesn't, you know, unprotected is used about, talk about sex much of the time. And I'm not going to do that. So not unprotected. They are uninsured, shall we say that. They are not covered by insurance. And when you've gotten to the middle class, but you feel that you're very, you know, vulnerable to all kinds of shocks, you're rich but unhappy. You're rich but anxious. You're rich but nervous. And that's a very bad state of mind. And if we think in those terms, I think we make some progress in trying to, first of all, understand why people were so upset, and secondly, what it is that we can do about it. I could go on and on and on, but I shall not. I propose that we do the following thing. Let's give Guillermo maybe 3 minutes to respond to 4 minutes or 5 minutes, but no more than that, so that I want to make sure that we have at least 15 or 20 minutes to engage in a dialogue with the audience. So,
okay,
four minutes, Guillermo.
Okay,
with Chileans, if you say four, they will talk for five, right?
But you need to be, you need to do the referee. So you will.
Okay, I will have a pito.
Okay,
a silbato.
Thank you very much. Let me choose because there were many very interesting things that were said here, and let me pick some of them, and I will go just in the order of they were said. One thing that is very important that Christian mentioned is the momentum for the structural reforms that lies ahead. I'm very, very, to some extent, worried, not because of the intentions of the people. There was an initial conventional process or constituent process made by Bachelet in her second government that was dismissed by the Piñera government, but dismissed intentionally, because they thought that the constitutional problem was not really a problem. Okay, this was dismissed intentionally. Now we are in a situation in which when you talk to people, except the extreme right, the rest, a big bunch of the right, and from then on, everyone says that the constitution must be changed. But nevertheless, we are risking not advancing in that regard. And that's a very significant problem. Part of the answer is that the center right and center left are paralyzed by the appearance of a new party made up of very unknown people. It's called Partido de la Gente. It's not People's Party because that's popular. Mm-hmm. How could you translate? This is out of my 4 minutes. How can we translate?
Partido de la Gente. Oh my God.
We're facing a very interesting linguistic problem because in Spanish, gente and pueblo have very clear political connections, right? Gente being more right wing and people, pueblo being more left wing. Whereas I'm not sure if in English, gentry would be one. I don't think they're as politically loaded.
That party is the closest we have to some kind of potentially populist country party with more or less right-wing orientation, and this is the center is paralyzed because they are afraid of losing, and that fear may end up freezing everything, all decision making, and therefore losing the momentum that you mentioned. Now, on what Javier mentioned, I believe that it's very important what we are not measuring. I like the question, what are we not measuring? There's something very strange, and a very distinguished like this should eventually start looking at this. When you look at the social tensions in Chile, they were decreasing after dictatorship. Of course, the initial years of dictatorship, there was a lot of social not upheavals, but a lot of social activities, and they were decreasing in their intensity up to 2005. Take strikes, legal or illegal, participation in demonstrations, signing up of letters, stuff like that. They were decreasing. In 2005, it's a very important year because it's the year that the constitution was reformed by President Lagos. Mm-hmm. So the constitution, 1980 constitution, was hugely reformed and very significantly reformed in 2005. But from then on, all those social tension indicators that were decreasing started to increase up to 2018. Almost, and take the one you like. So. How can we measure the temperature, if you want? I'd like to think how to create a thermometer mm-hmm. of social tensions. That's, I believe, we are not measuring that. And the other thing is that what happened to the political system that was unable to read that, because that was on the streets. I mean, if you went to Chile in 2006, you remember the students' manifestation of that year. In 2012, the same. So what happened to this? And that's where the constitutional enters and how the political system is blocked for different reasons. It was blocked before they changed to the electoral law, and it was blocked again, but for different reasons. We are blocked in that. This is very important. Now,
1 minute.
1 minute. I would like in this Three I's building, Institute of Inequality. What are the three I's?
Triple I.
Triple I.
International Inequalities Institute.
Okay. I believe we are attaching excessive relevance to income inequalities.
I agree.
There are many other inequalities which are very important. And this was mentioned by Andres. I fully agree with that. And that's why I started discussing or looking at private contracts to see why people may be disloyal to the contract that was really signed, because the social contract was never signed. So formal contracts are signed at some point in time, but nevertheless, people may be disloyal to that signature. Why? Most of the reasons have to do with different forms of inequalities, not just income inequalities. I put four families. The first one was return, which would be very close to income. But the distribution of risks in society is extremely important. I fully attach a lot of importance to that. How can you create exclusions? I mean, you can exclude formally. You can say you from this side of the room is not. You cannot do something, and you will. I don't know, send tomatoes over me, and you start complaining. So exclusions, at least today, in the 21st century, are never totally explicit, but you can have mechanisms of exclusion, which end up excluding some of you. Enough of you that I could don't care much about what you do. See? So understanding those mechanisms is very important. I've been very misinterpreted when I say that, but the market mechanisms, which I liked a lot in many dimensions of social life, which are very important for societies to prosper, in some areas, they create problems. And in particular, in social rights. Not in all social rights. I mean, because you can have today we are discussing, for example, the pension reform. So should the state be in charge of the computers in which the information of workers is deposited? You say, why? What's the reason that the state should take that in its control? It's absurd. That can be a private enterprise that can do that. It's just computers and the programs and engineers. You don't care about that. You can easily hand over that to the private sector. Now, the point of touch between the citizen and the pension system, I would rather have as neutral as possible the advice, as neutral as possible of commercial interest that may be linked in that. So that's my final point. I was a little bit longer than 4 minutes, but sorry.
We will forgive you. All right, everybody, the high table here has gone on for too long. And now, la gente or the pueblo, which one, Javier?
These are the people, those are the...
Okay. The floor is open for both gente and pueblo. Who would like to ask, make a comment? Yes, sir. Okay.
Thank you very much for the presentation, and I would like to introduce. My name is Ignacio Aravena. I'm Chilean too. I'm doing my PhD here now, and I would like to introduce another paradox, because there's been a huge narrative blaming the system, discussing about reforming, aiming to increase expenditure, and as you mentioned, it's not about economic growth. There are other ways of poverty, and well, Andres, Javier mentioned different issues. Besides being exposed to risk, vulnerabilities, and the fragile middle-income class, so on and so forth, the public sector doesn't look like they don't know very well what they are doing too, because if you look at multidimensional poverty, which is mostly related to housing and job access, if you look at the Gini after taxes, then you see that many things haven't changed for a while. So yeah, we can look at the economic trends and we can see, okay, we have an unbelievable case of successful, but in the socioeconomic part, then I think we have something that we haven't accomplished yet. So my question then is, what can we do? Because the private sector is not responding to it, but we've been increasing expenditure and the public sector is not doing their work yet. So what's left? How can we move forward on that?
I propose we take a few comments and then we go back to the panel. So floor is open again. Mr. Neut back there.
For the presentation. It's extremely interesting. I am also Chilean, living abroad for over 20 years, but following closely what's going on in our country. I agree with two questions. I agree with the vulnerability, uncertainty dimension, and the educational one that was stressed. And I think that one is key. I feel by that most people, discontent is linked with the fact that education did not deliver. It's expensive, but it did not deliver. So what about correcting this Gini distributional inequality indices, the income corrected by spending in education? Would that somehow reflect what's going on in Chile or not?
What do you mean by did not deliver? The returns were low?
The returns are extremely low. I mean, the OECD, I mean, you just see look at the educational, it doesn't deliver in many dimensions, but the OECD has measured this via the different countries, and definitely education in the test given to both high school students and whatnot, they rank much lower than other OECD countries, with similar expenditure correcting by many things, etc. So there is an issue with that, I think, and an important one, because talking about expectations into the long run, education is key. The other is, which I'm very worried about, is the violence seen in Chile. How much is it basically explained by an opportunistic intervention by drug lords, or whatever you want to call it? And that worries me a lot because of neighbors such as Colombia and Mexico. I mean, that's an outcome that's really worrisome for me, at least, and many. Okay.
Thank you, Alejandro. Over here, you had your hand up, right?
Hello, everyone. I'm Fernando Pino Magna. Also, I'm Chilean. I'm a student in the MPA first year here at LSE. More straightforward question is related with another actor, maybe it's very interesting, at least for citizens now, is the role of the press in Chile. So we have, in a few years, we have this, even this week, we have this new related with the machinery or the business with the fake news, even that out of politicians from right, also for left. And actually the convention was attacked very, very direct in this term. So in your opinion, very general opinion, who is this actor affects or not the expectation of the citizens, of the people now? Because it's not only an issue in Chile, actually it's an issue, I think, worldwide, so.
Fake news, are they more fake in Chile than elsewhere or just as fake? Over there, please, in the gray scarf.
Thank you. Christina Mellon with a background in environmental sciences. I have a question coming back to this idea of the combination of more than one crisis or one type of crisis. And for me, the question is, do we have the institutions to handle them? For example, now in Chile, is it clear who really owns this problem? Because if we don't know who owns the problem, how are we going to get to a solution?
Sorry, owns which problem in particular?
The fact that we have these different types of crises coming together. Mm-hmm. It seems like one department is responsible for one is responsible for the other, but mm-hmm. they're all happening at the same time.
All right. The gente got three questions. I think the pueblo should get three questions too. All right, back there. There you are.
Hi, it's Consuelo, also Chilean. My question is related mostly, as a Chilean that lived there through this whole estallido social, I really saw the shift from my generation towards politics in general and the feeling towards politicians. And in particular, feel this has impacted somehow the election and the voting process in general. We've seen larger participation from younger ages, etc. So also you, Andres, as a former politician. How do you foresee this in the future, how it may change the whole scenario, and what opportunities are rising? Mm-hmm.
So young people voting would be there. There in the white shirt, and then in the front, and then we will return to the panel. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Sofia. I'm from Uruguay. But I do agree that the case of Chile is paradoxical. So I'm researching Chile in my PhD and the constitutional process. So my question has to do with, I research communication and politics. Mm-hmm. And I wonder how much the fact that, for example, there were so many electoral events within the process of the constitution. So traditional politics, no, that were very challenged during 2019, sorry, like influence also the understanding of the people about the work in the constitutional convention and those dynamics within the.
So you're saying what mediated the understanding of voters of what went on in the convention?
We have in Chile national elections, but also parliamentary elections, so many different, local elections, many, many kind of traditional politics elections, no?
Right.
But the traditional political institutions were very much challenged in October 2019. So I wonder if you have an idea of how maybe these two things going in parallel, no, may have affected the work and the understanding of people about the constitutional convention.
Just to support that, Chile had 7 elections in 2 years, maybe a world record. Yes, in the front here.
Thank you. My name's Paula. I'm also Chilean, even though I don't sound it. my question is more about the difference. Sort of presented Chile as one country, and we always, obviously it's a country, and you mentioned plurinationality, but also you highlighted Santiago as having one sort of social landscape compared to the rest of the country. And I'd like you, if possible, to elaborate on that. What are the key issues that are really important in Santiago that don't happen outside of Santiago, or the other way around, where Santiago is leading usually politically, socially, on whatever's going on, but the rest of the country, in my understanding, doesn't necessarily follow in the same way, or doesn't have the same path. So, it would be really interesting if you could elaborate on that, if possible.
So Santiago versus the regions. Any other? Maybe nobody else. Nobody else. All right. Arauna. All right. All right. Caro, and then over here, and then we go back to the panel. I am not keeping my own promises. Shame on me.
Question from Zoom. Ellie Catherall asks, why did the poorest region of Chile, La Araucania, where inequality hasn't decreased notably, vote overwhelmingly for the right-wing presidential candidate cast and also for Rechazo?
Very good question. I have my own thesis, but I shall refrain from speaking on this point. Yes, sir. You had the floor.
Hello. Thank you for your speeches. Just a quick question. You elaborated on the role of and the impact of formal institutions, be it the education system, be it the pension system, and how the private-public differences interact in Chile. I want to ask the role of informal institutions, the socialization of the groups within themselves and among themselves, and the role of the elite and the elite guidance of the majority of the people, and how the informal institutions play out in this context.
Very well. Thank you very much for our comments, questions, objections, doubts, et cetera, et cetera. I propose we do the following thing. I propose we go back to the panel, but we leave Guillermo for the end so he can have the last word. So Javier, you have a couple of minutes, then Kirsten, a couple of minutes, then I may be tempted to say a thing or two, and then we'll go back to our main speaker.
May I ask if someone has a red pen?
A red pen?
Or a green, whatever.
Is that an ideological statement?
No, no, green, whatever.
How
no,
about
no.
a turquoise pen?
Perfect.
Okay. Javier, back to you.
Right. I'm going to refrain from talking about Andres and Guillermo's comments, going straight to the questions. And are we doing enough? What happens with public expenditure? I think your question about the premise is we're putting more money into the public system, but it doesn't seem to be happening. I would say maybe we haven't put enough. And there's a point about kind of welfare state and how can we reduce risk and uncertainty, right? So if the question is how do we reduce risk and uncertainty, the question then what is the role of welfare state policies in that process? I'm not an expert, so I'm just going to leave it there. Then in terms of the violence, I think, to me, it's a big question today in the country, and I think it also relates to the point about what's happening in the Araucanía, and to some extent, it will also be related to what's happening in the north, particularly in the areas which are more affected by kind of immigration. I'm not sure about the answer on that, but I think that it's something that we need to take into account. Because violence is not only about drug lords, and actually, if you look at evidence, drug lords usually prefer. I mean, they rule through violence, but they don't want chaos, right? They want some sort of level of formality in order to operate. So I think we're seeing a different expression of this particular problem. Then the question about the media. As someone who does research on misinformation, I'm always very skeptical about blaming the media about everything, mostly because we know a lot about media behavior over the years, and it hasn't changed much in many aspects. So media ownership has always been an issue, particularly kind of conservative forces. Rupert Murdoch has been around for many, many years, and also kind of all the media moguls. And if any, the standards that we hold press in many countries have improved over time. I think, though, that new technologies have allowed people to access and to bypass formal media. Even the more we produce regulation, or even not regulation, but in kind of some sort of controls of what media is doing, I would say that technologies have bypassing those elements, right? So we tend to react very clearly when misinformation comes from traditional media, but we don't realize that it's being peddled by a lot of kind of satellite media outlets that are kind of creating it. Who owns the problems? I can't remember who asked the question. I think that is a question for Chilean elites. And I think it's a very important question. I think that I'm not one of those people that think that it shouldn't be an elite, but I do think that one of the problems in Chile is that there's almost no merit in being in part of the elite, except for people getting elected into office, which there is some merit into it. Most of the people are born into this elite, and therefore, I think that brick comes with a kind of great powers come with great responsibility. Spider-Man won. So I think there's something there we need to think. I mean, elites tend to close themselves, and there's something we learn from both you. But I think they've taken it to the extreme in the case of Chile. And I'm going to end up with just the political side, young people voting. I think one of the most interesting exercises that happened throughout the constitutional process is my colleague Sergio Toro from Universidad Mayor, he is working in this with the Plataforma Telar, and they've been looking at different processes happening in families, right? So we know traditionally that political socialization happens from parents to kids, right? So that we, and anyone who has kids will know that we kind of load or dump a lot of information into them, and that shapes some of their preferences, right? What we're seeing in Chile now, it's reverse socialization. Because we have a lot of different generations of people that are not necessarily politically active for many years. And then from 2006 onwards, we're seeing a lot of kind of political activism from young people. We are seeing younger generations within families socializing politically the parents and the elders. And that is a very interesting phenomenon. I don't know what's gonna happen in terms of the outcome, but from kind of a political scientist perspective, it's a beautiful, interesting case. And also the question about elections, I think we need to understand, and this is coming from someone who works on public opinion, preference inconsistency is not a problem. It's a design feature because we change our minds and because people don't have time, energy to focus too much attention on their political problems. And that is not a bad thing. So it's not that they're being stupid. It's just they're more relevant things in their lives, in the day-to-day lives about, I don't know, they have a sick kid or they have problems in the family or the marriages or the work. There are many other things that are happening at the same time. So asking people to have consistent preferences in political terms is very difficult. And if we learn anything about political kind of public opinion research, it's that actually it's not a good idea to assume consistency. So we had a lot of elections, true. Does it matter? I'm not sure, because in a way, we are using a formal institution, but in a very kind of different way as we used to. And if any, I would say that the political leaderships that are rising at the moment in Chile, in my view, are coming from the local kind of municipalities. And that's the area in which I see some sort of political activism happening and grassroots processes. So if any, that maybe it's relevant from the institutional perspective.
Brilliant. Thank you, Javier. Kirsten, floor is yours.
Thank you. So first of all, thank you to Guillermo for emphasizing the fact that inequalities are indeed multidimensional. But you also asked, what aren't we measuring? And I think in that context, it's particularly important to also emphasize again that these 2019 protests didn't come out of nowhere, but that we had this process, you know, 2006, 2011, 2019. And the answer really is we were measuring a lot of things. So, you know, the UNDP did lots of reports on the various other aspects that could lead to conflict going forwards. COAS was founded to respond to these things. We measure a lot of things. But as one former minister once asked me, what good is COAS? You didn't predict the 2019 collapse. Well, I mean, nobody has a crystal ball, but I think there are things that we aren't measuring very well. And that's this gap between the aspirations and the reality. Which is incredibly difficult to monitor, in particular tying in with your point about the consistent preferences, which change very rapidly. And the other point I wanted to come back to was what Andres said at the beginning, where you're worrying about the fact that we've responded too quickly and have jumped on this theme in particular of inequalities in order to come up with solutions that without having really understood the impact and where this was coming from. I probably agree with you on that point, but the direction of the reforms and the fact that there is a new constitutional process aren't issues that shouldn't have, are going in the wrong direction necessarily. So you can argue about the process with which the constitution was undertaken this month. But the fact that there is a constitutional process, the fact that we are thinking about, you know, reforming the underlying structures of social insurance to improve this huge sense of vulnerability, I think that is going in the right direction. Having said that, none of this, I think, is a guarantee of social peace going forward. So it's going in the right direction, but you know, you can developed countries and advanced economies have these problems too, and they explode too sometimes.
They do.
And other Latin American countries who incidentally suffer from exactly the same issues in many circumstances worse, didn't explode in the way that Chile did. So there are factors here which I think we will never get to the bottom of about, you know, the circumstances of what triggered what when, and saying it was inequalities, in particular income inequalities, is not a sufficient answer. But there were clear indicators that this was in the right direction.
Brilliant. I'll say three things very briefly, and then we go back to Guillermo. Caro, can we go for another 5 minutes? Are we going to be ejected from the room? Okay, brilliant. Thank you so much. I mean, on this bit of knowledge and how much did we know, etc., let me just add one fact that everybody knows about, but we don't typically ponder enough. If you take the 2 years before 2019, it turns out that World Bank did a report on this, 47 different countries had massive social unrest and street protests. And that ranges from France to Hong Kong and from Bolivia to Brazil and from Chile to Iran. So as a social scientist, my first source of discomfort is when something is happening in a lot of places, which are very different, and the stories we tell are all about local causes, there's some cognitive dissonance there. I mean, there's something that is going on that goes beyond the particular policy of a particular country. Exactly what that is, I have no idea. I mean, the obvious answer is social media, you know, Twitter, and I'm perfectly happy to blame Twitter for everything. But could I make that into a scientific case? Probably not. You asked me about young people voting and compulsory versus voluntary voting. I think it is a wonderful thing that young people are more mobilized and voting. And I emphasize both, because mobilization without voting is not much good. You need both. I would add that probably one of the stupidest things that the Republic of Chile did, and I am partly to blame for that, not me, but the government that I was a part of, was to move to voluntary voting. I can say now, after many years, and you know, please don't tweet this right away. Wait 5 minutes, and before you tweet it, you know, this was actually discussed in the Comité Político, you know, within La Moneda, and you know, there were five ministers there. Four said yes, let's move in that direction. One minister said no, that's a really stupid idea. I will let you guess which minister that was. But we moved to it because the poll said, oh, it's very popular to have voluntary voting, okay? And it was a very bad idea on two counts. Count number one, on average, this is not always true, but it tends to be true, the rich vote more than the poor, and therefore in a country with legitimacy problems, to have a system which allows people with cars and nannies to vote and people without cars and without nannies not to vote is a very bad idea. And secondly, and this is something, for my taste, one of the big lessons of the referendum of a couple months ago, when voting is voluntary, people with very strong preferences and therefore with more extreme positions tend to vote. When voting is compulsory, you know, that mystical creature, the middle-aged, middle-class, middle-of-the-road voter, is suddenly compelled to come vote. And that changes political dynamics in a way that I personally find very positive. Others might disagree. And very quickly on what Alejandro said about returns and education, et cetera, and Javier said, we need to spend more money. Of all the items in the Chilean budget, by far the one that has gone up by most in the last 25 years is education. And as Guillermo showed, by any measure, private, plus public, Chile spends a lot of money on education. Now, why is it that returns have come down, which they have? For a very simple reason. When 10% of each cohort went to university, professionals were scarce and wages were high. When 50% of each cohort goes to university, naturally professionals are abundant and the return to being a professional has gone down. Question is that good or bad? From the point of view of the nation, it's great. We have a lot more professionals, right? From a point of view of the Gini, it's great. That's going to compress the Gini. Give it another 10, 15 years, the Gini is going to compress in Chile because professionals who tend to be at the top will be making relatively less than the average middle-class person. But politically, it's very bad. Why? Because there's a, you know, generación del sandwich, right? There's a, the generation in the middle that went to university with expectations of very high returns, which borrowed because typically they went to private schools where they had to pay fees. And then exposed, they found that the returns were lower and the interest rates were high. And that combination was very nasty. So the point I'm trying to make is that from the point of view of national welfare, that was a great transition. From the point of view of the people who were caught up in the transition, that was a very painful thing. But for the nation as a whole, that was not necessarily bad. If you happen to have, you know, a degree that doesn't pay and a big pile of debt, of course, you're very unhappy. And, you know, Transantiago is a good thing to burn from time to time. Okay, Guillermo, the floor is yours.
Okay, I took 7 pages of comments, so thank you very much. I will not answer them because if not, it will be too late. But let me make 2 or 3 comments that will encompass to some extent some of the other issues that have not been already answered by my colleagues here at the panel. Of course, the public sector needs an update. I mean, a little bit was you were mentioning, Ignacio. Everyone that knows the public sector in Chile agrees that it's not that bad, but it's far from the public sector that we need to have if we really want to become a developed country. But my point is that it's not about people. I would not say that the public sector works poorly because people are stupid. I would say that the rules in which they work mm-hmm. are poor. And therefore, how can we change the rules? And therefore, here I would like to mention once again the problems of governability. We have discussed with Andres many times in the past the problem of governability that Chile is suffering, not only in the today, which is very clear, in the last 2 or 3 years, but I would say, and I will be very, since the alternation of power took over. So we had the illusion that the Chilean state was very efficient because we have, for 20 years, for 17 years, we had a dictatorship with relatively clear rules of the game inside the public sector. I'm not talking about the politics. I'm thinking only of the rules inside the state. Then you have 20 years of concertación, which were basically more or less stabilized rules within the state. But when the alternation of power started, the rules were constantly changed. Mm-hmm. And therefore, people were expelled from higher positions in the government year after year. They started cheating on the nominations of people heading those agencies. And therefore, the state lost total the few capacity to really undertake long-term decisions and to stick to those strategic decisions. So my feeling is that we have a real problem with rules, much more than people. I mean, when you look at the staff, the quality of the staff in the government in many dimensions is very reasonable, I would say. And in some cases, as a central bank, most of all, but any in other agencies, is really of excellence. All the financial regulators, it's an excellent staff. We don't have problems there. Right. At the civil registry, it works fine. So the problems are the rules of the game in which those people relate. That's very important, I think. And why we do not change it? Because we have a governance issue. It's a problem. At the end of the day, it comes back, at least for me, into a political issue. Now, the informal institutions issue appeared twice. The problem is that informal institutions, we know that, evolve extremely slow. And we cannot really manage how today evolve. So the most we can do is to change formal institutions, which we are already not changing them as fast as we should. But informal institutions are very slow. That's one consideration. Second consideration, someone mentioned that a conclusion can we draw from the Chilean experience in the convention? The first, I would say, try to avoid as much as possible a convention. It's not a good solution. In Chile, and I agree with you, in the context of what was going on in 2018, they did the right thing. I don't blame the Congress because of what they did. The rules were fine and the convention solution was fine. But because the country was burning, you need to avoid burn any situation. So how can you do that if informal institutions are sticky? Is that on the formal side of the institutions, you need to be upgrading all the time. You need to be reforming all the time. You cannot spend, for example, in the pension case, we are now in the middle of the discussion concerning the pension reform. You cannot spend 12 years saying, we shall do something with an increase in the tax, contribution rate. Yeah, contribution rate. Yeah. For 12 years without getting an agreement on what to do with that. So the gap between expectations and reality, of course, worsened significantly in that case. So my hunch here is we should be, and once again, this is a governance issue. We are not reforming our formal side of the contract as fast as we should. So we let a lot of time pass without really modernizing that formal part of the social contract and until it explodes.
Very well. So you heard it from Guillermo Larraín. It's not the economy stupid, it's the politics stupid. Maybe that's a good thought on which to end this wonderful evening. Thank you very much, Javier. Thank you very much, Guillermo. Thank you very much, Kirsten. Thank you very much, everyone who joined.
Thank you.
See you soon.